Good evening. Thank you for coming to Summer Minds. This is the third year of Summer Minds at Oriella Park, to whom we are very grateful, especially Katie Withington. Is she hearing? Katie, we're thanking you in here. So I want you to cast your mind back. I'm thinking 1970s, late 1970s, early 1980s. You're soaking up the sand on White Sands Beach. And a bit further along the beach, there's a little boy who's building a dam. You know the stream as you come onto White Sands Beach?
Yeah.
And he's building a dam with his siblings. He's building and building until he gets quite high. And then he and the siblings run off and hide and just wait and watch as the water builds up. And of course, eventually it gets very high and it pushes against the barriers of the dam and it flows out and all of these sunbathers get cold water. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Daniel, Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's great to have you.
Great.
And Danny is going to speak for 40 minutes, and then we're going to hand over to you all for questions. So I'm going to hand over.
Great. It might be less, it might be 30, because I'm most interested in the questions. There's a seat down here, if anybody wants a seat and are brave, come down quietly. Yes, I have to admit it was me if you were flooded on the beach at White Sands. We came every year, we camped, and the beach is wonderfully flat, and that stream used to be a bit more full. And it wasn't just me and my siblings. If you started off damming that stream at about 10 in the morning, you could collect more and more children who got bored. And our high point was having about 50. And then you'd get the water really high. And I was tempted today to have a go, but there's a sandcastle competition on and it wouldn't have been fair to do that. Anyway, enough about White Sands Bay and St David's. I'm going to talk to you about geography. I've just only got a dozen slides. I'm just going to show you some pictures. Geography back in the 1970s, 1980s, when I did it at university, was a very different subject to what it is today. Quite a lot of you would have... Who did O-level geography, just out of interest? That's a majority. GCSE geography? Minority, okay. I've worked out my cohort. I did O-level. You may well remember, it was about resources. It was about the empire, in effect. It was where you get rubber and tin from. The subject was created 100 years ago in this country to train colonial officers, because we needed to teach people about mountains and rivers and streams and dams, but also about markets and goods, because we were going to send them out to Nigeria and Ghana and Malaysia, and they were going to be colonial officers. And that's the bulk of the history of the subject, and that's why Oxford University created one of the first geography departments in the country. We then had a problem, because India won independence, and then throughout the 1960s, one country after another won independence in Africa. Although, nobody here has taken their citizenship test, have they? No. Oh, first time. To pass the citizenship test, you mustn't say won independence. You must say we granted them their freedom. It's an amazing what that history is. The colonial officers came back, there were no jobs for them, and they were given jobs as geography lecturers. And I was taught by ex-colonial officers at university. And the subject was in a bit of a dire strait, because it didn't need... there wasn't a need for people to do this anymore, to rule. Physical geographers, geography splits into two kinds. I'm a human geographer. We call the other side the non-human geographers, but they're the physical geographers. Physical geographers like going for walks. And as an excuse for going to walks, they used to climb up mountains, particularly in the Alps, to measure the glaciers to see how near the coming ice age was. Because again, if you did O-level geography then, you would have been taught that an ice age was coming. The world was getting colder, we were going to freeze. And they would go back the next year and measure the glacier again. They thought something was going wrong. And eventually, after many years of this, they noticed that the glaciers were actually going backwards. And this was very good for geography. Geography is now one of the subjects which is at the heart of climate change science, because it was geographers who discovered that glaciers are actually eroding, that the world is heating up. And on the human side of geography, and this is much more recent, in the last 10 years, inequality and differences between people has become paramount. If you look at the world's business leaders who meet in Davos every year, they produce a list of the 31 biggest threats of the world, which I always think should include them, but they've never been ready to do that first. A couple of years ago, that the top three were climate change, inequality, and unemployment, interestingly, worldwide. And geography now as a subject looks at two of these things. So we've gone on a kind of journey from quite an embarrassing past, through purely by luck, becoming a discipline which is increasingly about the future. It's almost like the opposite of history. It's about speculating on what might happen. And we have a pretty much free rein as geographers to look at different things. As long as it's got some connection to area and space, you're allowed to look at it. Let's show you some pictures. These are three books I was involved in this year, if you're interested, to give you an idea. So one is about politics, because there's nothing to stop you if you're a geographer talking about politics. Geographers get funding from all the research councils of Britain, apart from astrophysics. We can't convince anybody that we actually know about astrophysics. But everything else, you know, flooding, the arts, we get to look at. A little bit on geography, and I'm going to mainly show you pictures in this little book on geography written with Carl Lee, who for 25 years was an A-level teacher in Sheffield, now teaches at Sheffield University. And People and Places, a book about the UK and how it's changed. Because I'm an unusual geographer, I draw maps still, or I work with people who can draw maps, but strange maps. Most geographers no longer use maps very much, which I think is a bit sad. But we use weird maps of the world. Before I show you a map, what I really want you to think about is how much has changed in most of our lives, apart from the two people who put up their hands to say they've done GCSEs. It defines you're too young to have seen this life. I saw this life in black and white in 1969. I was very small, but I was alive. That image of the Earth did change people's views of the planet. And we've had many other images since then that have actually altered how we think about where we are. We adapt to them very quickly, so we don't notice that our attitudes have changed. If I could take you back in time to when you were 15 or 16, you would be shocked by the kind of things that people said then. You would be horrified by some things, but we kind of forget it. We have rose-tinted glasses. And one reason to say that, of course, is you've only got to project forward 30 years and then worry, what do we say now that we think is common sense that people will say was absolutely horrific in terms of how we describe or talk about things? And I'll get on to a few of those more controversial things later. I'm interested in this partly because I grew up in the city of Oxford. As a teenager, I didn't like it. It's a small town, very snobby. There were these very strange students who used to wear very strange clothes and used to trash restaurants. I was 17 in 1985 and 18 in 1986, so you can work out who was there. And I left at 18 to go away as far as I could. I wasn't very adventurous, so I went to Newcastle, which is as far as you can go in England. And then came back to Oxford 3 years ago. It's very strange coming back to the place you grew up, finding somewhere to live, and then trying to find schools for your children as a middle-class person. The upper class tend to send their children to the same schools they went to and pay a lot of money to do so. And the working class often send their children to the same school that they went to because they don't move. But if you're middle class, you're not really supposed to go back to where you grew up. Strange map about changes, very, very long-term changes. Has anybody been here? It's in Turkey now. That's not a change. It's the world's oldest city. Catalhulik, I think it's pronounced, almost certainly got it wrong. And it's a map of the city that was found on one of the old walls of it. Could be as old as 10,000 years. Has anybody noticed anything strange about it? It's unusual.
There's no roads.
To get to your house, you climbed over other people's roofs. It's an extreme example of trying to understand about change. You might think the roads and alleyways and so on are obvious, but when we first created cities, they weren't. And you can come much more up to date about this. Sewers, big sewers on a big scale. In this country, well, not this country, sorry, in that country, over there, my mum would murder me. She's a Welsh speaker. In that country over there, the first proper sewer system was put in Manchester. And it was only put in after cholera had killed enough people to make people really think it was worthwhile putting in. So you can look at a map of a city from 10,000 years ago and think, oh yes, that's silly, we're all developed now. But Manchester, you're only looking at 160 years ago for actually thinking that you really need a sewer system. Things do change quite quickly with accelerating speed. Okay, the first map, and don't worry, there's only about 10 of these, and only one graph. This is a map of the world that I'm very familiar with, which may look odd to you, probably should look odd to you. How many people have seen a map, forget about the arrows at the moment, a map that looks like this? Yeah, younger, that's good. Now, one older. This is now part of GCSE geography. So if you were taking a GCSE exam last year or the year before, they actually have these maps in and they ask people to interpret them what they mean. It's the world stretched so that each little square is made proportional to the number of people who live there. So we are here, cold little rock on the edge of Europe. About 1%, less than 1% of the world's population, only 0.5% of the world's children. The rest of Europe isn't that big. Africa's fairly large. This is Nigeria now, pretty big. This is Lagos. India, over a billion, looks quite big. China is quite big. The Americas are relatively small. It's a world map of current population, which I think is about 7.3 billion people. It should really be a map of all the people who've ever lived. But people are not very good at working out all the people who've ever lived. You would have thought it wouldn't be that hard, but sadly, enormous numbers of people have only lived for a few days. That's why it's difficult and fairly depressing to try to work out how many lives there's ever been. But if it was a map of all the people who'd ever lived, Africa would be a bit larger, because we depopulated Africa through slavery and colonisation and disease. Europe would be a bit smaller. We're actually, in world history, unusually large because we had the first world population explosion. It began in France and then it spread. As we enclosed fields, people were forced to move to towns. As you do that, the normal social norms that should have existed in St. David's for centuries of behaving yourself quite well, waiting till you get married, and not having too many children break down, our populations went up. Happened across Europe. Europe produced enormous numbers of people by 1820, 1830s, 1840s, and we were the mass immigrants of the world. We don't often tell ourselves this story, but of course we flooded into the United States, into Canada, into Australia, into New Zealand. For most of the last 150 years, the UK has been an emigrant nation. More people have left than have come in. For all the recessions, apart from the most recent one, the 1970s recession, the big 1980s recession, and the little 1990s recession, we were an emigrant nation, more going out than coming in. That wasn't the case with the 2008 crash, because there was nowhere to go, because it was a global crash. Mm. Because it was a global crash, there were lots of other people looking for somewhere to go, and we speak English. That happened before in 1929. In the 1929 global crash, the 31 census actually showed that more people came in than went out. India and China are about the right size they should be. This is where the bulk of the world population have lived for a very, very long time. The Americas are a little bit too big if you were trying to do a map of all the people who've ever lived. But I'll get off my obsession about that map, which I'd love to draw, of all humanity ever. The arrows are showing the current best guesses for when people arrived in various places in time. And there are huge variations, 120,000 years ago to 75,000 years ago for leaving Africa. We're fairly good at the endpoints. Places that people haven't been for, didn't get to fairly recently, it's relatively easy to work out when they arrived, because there aren't many, isn't evidence of them appearing before. It's only 8,000 years before the current era for us. Some incredible movements. Madagascar, the number of people who must have died and never got across that strait, is enormous. New Zealand just 800 years ago. But that's the spread of humanity. The reason for showing you this is to talk about the restlessness of human beings. We're not all restless. We vary. Some of us are quite sedentary. We're quite happy to stay where we are. Other people just really have a get up and go and have to get somewhere. We move down the Americas at a speed of about a mile a year when human beings first came in and destroyed all the big animals and so on. But it's just one way of looking at humanity and its movements. Let me speed up because I can go on too long. This is the only graph I'm going to show you. It goes from 1850 around here to about 15-16 years ago. It's not of population, it's of population change. And this really fascinates me. Around about here there are a billion people in the world. And population was pretty stable, a small increase between 0.1 and 0.5% a year. Human population increased sixfold when we went from hunter-gathering to settling and farming. A sixfold increase over many generations, 20 or 30 generations. And then it only rose very, very slowly. But then, from 1850 onwards, we had population growth itself growing. We went from a billion people then to now around about 7 billion people on the planet, much quicker than that increase when we went from hunter-gathering to farming. It's an algae bloom, if you like. This occasionally happens in species, and it's happened to us. And it's happened in the last six or seven generations. And it's a dramatic event. There's a lovely phrase in Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, who was writing around about here, and had no idea that what he was writing would fit what happened to human beings, where he said occasionally in the histories of a species a few favoured seasons can occur and numbers can multiply beyond any expectation. And the fascinating thing is that that happened to us. It began in Europe, and then of course when we went out to the rest of the world and took control of most of the rest of the world, we disrupted all the equivalents of St. David's all around the world. All around the world, people had stable social systems which through various ways stopped population going up or down too much. If you colonise and take over a country, you disturb that. If you build up new towns and industries, you break down social ties. If you have no respect for people's religions because they're not Christian and you tell them that their religion is silly, then they're going to stop obeying the rules of their religions, often which got them to control themselves. And so the rest of the world got a population explosion, largely due to us. We're not very good at admitting our culpability in these kinds of things. It's not our fault. if you want, we'll get on to questions. If you want to know why I think it was us, I can tell you why it's us, but we were there. The increase in population itself rises. So you've got something, and it's getting bigger, and it's getting bigger at a bigger percentage every year. Around about 1960, here, a mathematician worked out that within 300 years, if the human population carried on increasing at that rate of just over 2%, the entire planet would be a swarming mass of human bodies all touching each other. Now, it's a fairly disgusting view. What that mathematician was saying, but he was too polite to say it, is that you could tell that couldn't continue. He could tell we were at a maximum. When about 1968, the population bomb was published, the book about just how terrible things were. The little dips in this, by the way, they're like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. This is the global influenza pandemic. It's not World War One. World War One was very small. Big for us, but you know, it wasn't really a world war. We just like to call it one. That's World War Two, which was a world war. Many, many more deaths. So that's disease. That's war. This is famine. Anybody know where it was? You're looking at the six. No, that Bangladesh was bad, but not a really big famine. Yeah, China. I got criticised in the book I wrote just for not talking about it. Anyway, it's there. That is Ethiopia. Will it snow at Christmas, 1984? If you can remember all that. Since 1971, we've had this incredible thing for almost all of my life. And this is incredibly good news. This is a deceleration in the growth of population. Now, most of this, the fact we're still rising, you don't get to steady state until you get down to here. That's zero population growth. Most of this is not babies. Peak baby was around about 1990. So we're at peak 25-year-old now. We've got incredible slowing down in fertility. Most of the world is below two children per couple. So it's not babies. So why is population still growing if it's not babies? Yeah, you know, I'm going to make it more complicated. It's us. If life expectancy doubles, as it's done in the world, then the same number of people ends up being twice as many people than before. So it's not necessarily bad news, it's mainly longevity. The bit I haven't updated or shown you, partly because the latest figures are incredible, is this isn't just carrying on, it's actually going down faster. The reason not to get too excited about that, although I do get quite excited about it, is we've had the biggest worldwide economic crash since 1929, which might partly explain the acceleration in the fall of children worldwide. China's relaxed its one-child policy because it's worried about not having enough people in the future, and in the experimental areas where it relaxed, it found that people do not, on average, want two children anymore. Tokyo's at just over one child, Barcelona's at 1.1 child, Italy's at 1.3. We're the highest fertility country, I think, in Europe, because we managed to get to 1.9 recently. We only got to 1.9 because everything came together. All the women who've been delaying having children because they've gone to university, a large group of them finally had them, often in their early 40s. We had a relatively high rate of immigration, partly because we didn't have many children in the 1970s. Very low birth rate. Immigration follows birth rates wonderfully. When we didn't have children in the 1930s, we imported lots of people in the 1960s of the age at which we would have had them in the 1930s and got them to work on the buses and in the hospitals. When we didn't have many children in the 1970s, we imported lots of people in the late 1990s and on, because there were jobs for them to do. Anyway, it is still heading down. There's a huge disagreement because slight changes in this alter whether by the end of the century we end up with not impossible just to have 8 billion. I think 9's more likely. UN used to say 10. There's a slight baby boom worldwide, and the UN then said 11, which is its current number. But the UN doesn't take into account baby booms. UN Global Projections. I'm going to talk for 40 minutes, I should say, but no longer than that. UN Global Projections are made by a small group of people actually in that slab, that concrete block in New York. And they're very good. They have to get all countries to agree. And UN projections assume for some reason that we will in 300 years hit a steady state of 2 children per couple. Now all the evidence is suggesting that when you give people some form of security, social security, so that you don't worry about your old age, if you worry about your old age you need to have more children, when you start treating women as being human, which is the biggest change in the last century, when you have the best contraceptive of all, which is getting a degree, there's nothing that reduces fertility more than sending people to university. It doesn't just stop them having children at 18, 19 or 20 when at university. They don't have this idea that they're going to have a career and so on. And that university students worldwide are zooming up massively. I mean, there are many other reasons to want lots of people to go to university in the world, but the effect on fertility is incredible. So we can talk about that more later. You might worry about food. So here's the world with every small square the size of the amount of crops it produces. This is where our food comes from and probably will come from in future. I'm very used to these maps and I do worry about... I'll leave it up for a few seconds about looking at it. But, you know, the Great Plains of America, the steppes of Russia, if you worry about food, the wonderful thing about food, I know this is pretty simplistic, but imagine if you could actually eat as much as you wanted, what kind of a problem we'd have. Now the wonderful thing about food is that if you, as I can demonstrate by standing in front of you, if you eat just a few more calories a day than you ought to, you very quickly get fat. Because we can't consume endless amounts of food, we can certainly waste a huge amount. In rich countries where we waste a huge amount, in poor countries a huge amount is eaten by rats and other animals. But globally at the moment, we are producing more food than we actually need. We have a bigger obesity crisis, an overeating crisis, certainly waste crisis, than we have a lack of food in places where there still isn't enough food. Add another 2 billion people, and if you become more efficient in how you produce food, or what you do with it, you can feed another 2 billion people. We can do that with current technology. The technology is called don't feed as much to cows and pigs and chickens. Doesn't mean you don't have to eat cows and pigs and chickens, but just don't eat them every day. Which is what happened when I was a child on White Sands Bay in the early 1970s, because that man who founded Tesco's hadn't yet created his massive chicken industry. The most common bird on the planet is now chickens. There are lots and lots of things we can do which are relatively simple. And even better than that, eating a little less meat is actually good for us. Yeah. There are worse problems with water. There are problems with soil and soil erosion. There are huge problems with global warming. There are big problems in reducing our use of cars and the amount we fly. There's a lovely relationship between inequality and flying. The more unequal countries of the rich world have many more people flying in private jets. Oxford has its own little private airport. You can only use it if you've got a private jet. London is surrounded by airports. You can see them that you can't use because you're not an executive and you can't fly from there. And Piketty and a colleague whose name I forget have done some work, which is a bit disputed, but suggesting that there is a very high carbon footprint from inequality and people who are quite well off choosing to fly in quite small planes very often. And you could reduce that. German business people tend to use a train because the trains in more equal countries are generally more efficient and better run. The more unequal rich country you have, the less public services work well, the less public transport works well, So the United States doesn't manage to have a train system and has a system dominated by cars. But I'm going off food. It's just, food is, I think, the easy one, mainly because you cannot consume more and more of it. We would have a real problem if you could, whereas you can consume more fuel, you can travel more. So getting people to reduce that is harder. Here's a map of pollution, a particular kind of pollution. You've all seen this map, you just haven't seen it drawn this way. This is the Earth at Night map, which is a map made by NASA from taking a whole series of satellite photographs and putting them together. When you normally see this map, you think that what you're seeing is a map of where people are. But here, we've reprojected the map onto a population map of the world. So anywhere where there are no people, we've shrunk away. And we've made everywhere the size of the number of people that live there. So this is the Sahara. We've just shrunk it to that band. The Himalayas are here. Just pushed them away. The world's largest city is Chongqing, which is actually quite not too shiny. This is Tokyo over there. If I had a better projection on a bigger screen, you can actually, on this projection of the world, see streets within London and Tokyo. It's a world map in which you can see streets. And that's quite, I don't know, you can see I'm a bit weird. That excites me. You can see other things. Who's been to New Zealand? Yeah, that's interesting. Quite a few of you. Here's New Zealand. That tiny dot of light is Auckland. New Zealand, of course, has been shrunk because there aren't many people there. And if you just imagine being a 15, 16, 17-year-old in New Zealand, a bit like growing up in Oxford, which is a small place you want to get away from, you can see when you've just got that one little dot of light why you might want to go from there to the bright lights of London. You know, it's very, very exciting. Anyway, the point of showing you this is this map no longer shows you where people are, because people are everywhere on this map. Equally distributed. We've shed it out so they're all over. So this is a map that shows you people who can afford to use energy to send light up in the sky so you can do a satellite image of them. So it's light pollution. What we don't know is whether the people here in the rest of Nigeria and Lagos don't have light or are using the light they have got efficiently when they're reading at night, that they're not shining streetlights and other things up in the sky. We did a map of this a few years earlier, and the depressing thing then was that the Nile Delta in Cairo was much less bright. That's brightened up. Although if the Americans gave Egypt less money, I think that might help. The good news was that Tokyo has become darker. And this current image was taken after the tsunami. When the tsunami hit Japan, they turned off all the nuclear power stations. The nuclear power stations supplied about 24% of all the electricity in Japan. The world didn't end. The old people didn't start dying in hot summer, even though the air conditioning had to be turned off. People had to walk upstairs rather than use the lifts, unless they had to use the lift. And they turned quite a lot of the signs off in Tokyo. There's neon signs, which are still a lot left, but when you lose 24% of your electricity, you have to do something. And Tokyo actually got darker. It shows the kind of things you can do. But that's an image, I think, of where we are currently overspending, where you could actually do something. This is Moscow, which I always like. Soviet planning does produce very pretty pictures. Lovely geometrical signs. There's a geographer called Kristaller, I think a German geographer, who produced a theory about how cities should be arranged on a plane. And then the Soviet planners actually took it to decide how they were going to put the cities. Let's just show a couple of maps of Europe, and then I'll bring it to an end. And please think of some questions for me. So here's our part of the world with some colleagues. Dimitris Ballas from Greece and Ben Hennig, who's born in Switzerland but is from Germany and is about to go, it's missing. He's just off to become a lecturer in Iceland, which is up there. We did an Atlas of Europe a couple of years ago. Ben and Demetrius are very pro-Europeans because they've lived in many different countries. apart from a little bit of time in New Zealand, I've only lived in England. That's what Europe looks like if you draw Europe by population. Each small part, so not just the whole country, but that's London in England. Mm-hmm. We are here, most of Wales is the valleys. You can see where we are. We do actually appear, but we're not that big. A large amount of Ireland is Dublin. There's Paris in Spain. You can see how big Madrid is. You can see that Greece, should be careful about, Greece is a country, but it's mainly a city. It's mainly Athens. When people are talking about the Greek crisis, they're really talking about the bankruptcy of one city. And you can see the kind of lobster of Turkey biting in from the edge. The colours aren't random. The colours are the rainbow scale, with the darkest violets for those countries that joined the European Union or formed it first, and then going through backwards, if I can do violet, indigo, through to green. And so Turkey is red because it has an intention to join sometime in 30 years, going backwards in time. And all the Eastern European countries are green because they joined recently. Switzerland is yellow because it's kind of in Europe. Free movement of labour, free trade, doesn't get any votes. A bit like Norway. So if you can memorise that map, okay, you've got that. Got that now. I'll just show you one distribution on it. I think this is my second to last map. This is the number of people in each region of Europe who were born in another country. It's the latest data, so it's 2014. The map would almost certainly be almost exactly the same today. And an area is coloured dark blue, such as the middle of London, if more than 20% of the population were born abroad in another country. It's medium blue, 15 to 20, so that's East London. It's this kind of turquoisey colour, if it's 10 to 15, so that's South London. So you can basically see that for us, London is the area of high immigration. The other area is Northern Ireland, often because people were born in a republic. Very high immigration in Spain, particularly the Costa del Sol. Lots and lots of immigrants. The Balearics, high concentration. I'm afraid Cyprus has just dropped off, but Cyprus is a nice blue colour. These, of course, are a few Welsh, but mainly English people, and some others. Switzerland, incredible immigration. An incredible rate of immigration in Switzerland. Of course, the smaller your country is, the higher the immigration rate will be. Andorra has an enormous rate. That's Paris, and you can almost see the higher immigration rates on the edge of Paris, of a kind of lack of integration that might have been a bad idea, if you think about it. But if you just look across Europe for the capitals of various states, it's the same as London. Scandinavia's taken in people recently. These are the Baltic states. The reason for stretching the map by population is to stop you obsessing about somewhere where nobody lives. Otherwise you spend all your time looking at north of Norway and Sweden, and it really doesn't matter what's happened there. And to get you to concentrate on absolute numbers of people. So in effect this is telling you where the most immigrants are across Europe. And although we've had net immigration for many years now, we're not immigration central in Europe. Partly because these other places, people come and go. So there's a high turnover of population. And the fascinating thing for me about this is that the highest immigration rates are in two of the three regions that voted Remain. And it wasn't the immigrants voting because they were not allowed to vote. It's the British friends and neighbours of the immigrants who were voting. Pretty low rates. Eastern region and East Midlands were the biggest leave rates. The other area that voted to remain was Scotland, but that Scotland had different reasons why it voted to remain. Scotland has a different way of expressing its anger. Anyway, that's just one example. You can do lots and lots of these maps where you draw one thing over another. And I'm not showing you the normal map, but it's a very different picture. You know, London would be tiny on the normal map, but London is a big place. Final map. This is the way I see the world, and I've made it even stranger. The only difference here to the ones I've been showing you earlier is that we've just taken the oceans out and the seas and made them much smaller. Now, the oceans and the seas are very useful for you not thinking that those first images were too strange. I think you could just about work out what you're looking at. Here is very different. We are up here, a shrinking part of the world. You know, even though we've had net immigration of a few hundred thousand, our actual share of world population is shrinking dramatically, just 0.5% of the world's children. We would have to have much higher immigration if we're just to keep the same size. Even bigger shrinking in Germany, although 1 million Syrians abates that a little bit, but not usually. In a continent of, depending on where you draw the boundary of Europe, 500, 600, even 700 million people, you have to have 7 million coming in to talk about just 1%. Actually quite small numbers. The centre of the world is a small village in the middle of India. We've actually identified it, and me and Carl were very good not to buy a plot of land at the world centre, partly because it moves, so we'd feel a bit silly. But that's the centre of the world. Bangladesh is up here. Talking earlier about famine and floods and so on. Population is really slowing down there. It's decelerating in India. It's not huge. India looks very big, but for most of world history, India was this size of population. China is going to have to deal with children who've got 4 grandparents, 2 parents, and there's only 1 child. And China's done a one-shot go. It's very good economically to have few children. You can have a huge number of workers if you don't have many children to look after, but you have an issue in the future. Japan shows how you can deal with that issue. Japan has successfully aged, has dealt with incredibly low fertility rate, had an almighty housing crash at the end of the 1980s, and has had 2 decades of lost growth, but the world hasn't ended. It still has the highest life expectancy in the world. People put their only child in the front of a bike and take them to school. Things carry on. There's a fascinating thing about to happen in various parts of the world that's already begun, where it becomes normal to be an only child. Most children are only children. And we don't know what's going to happen when that occurs. Presumably people will get better at having friends. and if we get better at having friends, it might make us more sociable. But that's the image of the world I have. I don't worry usually about population growth. The areas of the world that still have 4, 5, or even 6 children per mother may well slow down in the future. There are incredible projections for the population of the Yemen, but that's partly because we're putting bombs on the Yemen. You know, if you really want to increase the population of a place, you bomb it. People have more children when that occurs. The other way in which you can increase the population of a place is putting a wall around it. So the Gaza Strip has incredible birth rate. How else can you expect yourself? In the rich world, the only part of the rich world which used to have more than 2 children, just over 2.2 per couple, was the United States. And recently even that has come down. So we're facing a very, very different and very interesting future. And White Sands Bay, just to end with. So lots of different issues, lots of things I'm interested in. Please ask me your questions about any of this or anything you think is related to geography, and I'll do my best, particularly to tell you if I haven't got a clue. And geographers can be very bad at not saying they haven't got a clue. Because of that early training of being sent out to run countries, the one thing you learnt was to pretend you knew what you were doing, even if you didn't have a clue. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's get some questions going. Yes.
Thank you very much, Gabriel Scali. Thank you very much, philosophers interpret the world in various ways. Point out ways to change it. Geographers clearly map the world's population in different ways. But do they produce any change in the world through the mapping?
Oh, does the mapping have an influence?
Yes.
Well, we've mapped elections in this kind of way for several decades. So the maps give you an idea about how elections work would be better than a normal map. Whether that actually alters people's political behaviour, I think, is yet to be seen. We used to produce maps which had incredible stereotyped images of people. You know, if you look at 1930s textbooks, you'll find people with spears and savages and then people with top hats. We used to tell people a story about the world that told them that if they were English and white, they were superior. Mm. We're now increasingly careful not to do that. We produce maps which treat people very equally, or we try to, and I suspect that that has an almost subconscious effect. In the 1970s, there was a cartographer from Germany called Arno Peters. And Peters produced a projection, which the United Nations adopted, which just showed land proportional to area. It wasn't that revolutionary. Africa was quite big because it's quite big. Before the Peters projection, which you may have had up on your classroom wall, before the Peters projection, the Mercator projection was used. And the Mercator projection was popular. The Mercator projection is very good if you're trying to sail a ship across the ocean, because all compass lines are a straight line. But that wasn't why it was used. It was used because it makes Russia look absolutely enormous. And in the 1950s and 60s, particularly in the United States, but also here, we had an enormous fear of Russia. So changing your projection actually changes how people think about the world. The Peters projection became the UN projection, not because it was fairer, but because in the UN, on mapping, every country gets an equal vote. And there were an enormous number of countries in the Caribbean, which are also given a lot more space. He did an atlas, and there were three entire pages of the Sahara. I think we'll get to at some point, and it's interesting that Ben Hennig is from not very far away from where Arno Peters grew up, or Mercator, who is also German. It's slightly annoying, it's always Germans who do the best maps. But I can see at some point in the future population maps becoming the normal map, and then you're constantly thinking about where most people are and not thinking about other people as being that different. No, I think if I fly from here down to here, I view myself as flying over this particular map. When I came to St. David's, I actually think of myself as travelling on a population cartogram of Britain. It just takes an awful long time to come that last little bit. There aren't many people. But from that point of view, you have this enormous London. It explains why London dominates so many things. It's not just that London over-dominates. There really are a lot of people there. And then Oxford is a fairly small town that's jammed between Birmingham and London. And it's a different way of thinking about it. So I think the projection has a bigger effect than the more obvious things that we map and say, and it's almost subliminal.
More questions? Yeah. Andy,
could you give us your thoughts about the sort of relationship between information about place, sort of big data and risk?
Yeah.
So, you know, I do a lot of work with government, and there's almost no understanding of the actions that need to be taken to deal with medium to long-term risks.
Yes.
Yet that information is available. How do we go about using the mapping of information in a way that helps policymakers actually do different things?
Let me go back to a normal world map. So, on this particular map, if you increase sea level, on here, you can see the sea coming in, not in Africa because it's quite high up, but in the coast of Europe and the Netherlands and in Tokyo, which just goes under, the sea floods in because so many people live on very low altitude near to the sea. On a normal map, increased sea level doesn't look like much of a problem. There are lots of data sets of disasters and future projections as well as of what might happen, and not much use is made of them. One problem is that we've got better at dealing with disasters, so the number of people who actually die in floods has reduced dramatically worldwide, even though the chance of flooding and the floods are getting bigger, so that's quite difficult. The other reason why I think British geographers are a bit quiet about mapping risks of climate change is that the current scenarios, it's still bad for Britain, but Britain and the Korean Peninsula are the two areas that under projections are least affected. And one problem is us not understanding it really doesn't matter if we're least affected. If the rest of the world is very badly affected, it's not really going to help us very much. Mm-hmm. That might explain why British geographers don't produce so many maps, because the chance of being complacent is quite high, unless the North Atlantic Oscillation ends, you know, and then we're going to get very cold very, very quickly. And my O-level textbook would have been correct, at least for Britain.
More questions? Oh, yeah.
Going back to thinking about your interesting graph, it is natural, I suppose, to think about when will we reach no growth in the human population, and I don't know the details of the bits that are missing, but I assume we're talking about 2060, are we, 2070?
We thought 2060 and 2070.
Yes.
Here's the problem, so slightly long answer to this. There was a worldwide population boom around about 1946. It was exactly 9 months after the first men came back from the war. There was a mini one after the First World War. 1946, 47 big year, 48 big year. If you had a hard life and you were born in any of those years, you know it's from Eastland, you were competing with more people for jobs and houses and so on. It wasn't just the US and Europe that had that population boom. I will answer the question, but I've got to explain this. Indian independence also led to a population boom in India, which wasn't well recorded. The revolution in China led to a population boom. 25 years later, there's another population boom in the 1960s, peaks in 1965. I'm the tail end of that in 1968. 30 years later, in rich countries, because people wait a bit longer, we get another population boom, but less of a gap in poorer countries. And then we had a little echo of one in 2010. This caused the United Nations to say it will not be until 2110 till we hit stability. But a tiny change in fertility has an enormous effect. Anything you do that makes the world more stable, that makes it feel like a safer place, that reduces wars, that gives women more respect and lets more women into universities, will accelerate this, and the date could be 2050 or 2060 if that happens. It's a slow landing on that particular point, and it's shocking what the variation is. The UN also produced two other projections, because we always talk about the median, and I should talk about the other. There's what's called the high projection and low projection, because you were very good on that. Anybody know what the high projection and low projection is, how they work it out? It's all about it. The high projection assumes that every woman in the world has half an extra baby. That's it, it's no more sophisticated than that. And the low projection assumes that they have half a baby less. And that's it, that's our world population projections. That's as clever as they get. And they include nothing in the projections for future behaviour of the population due to increased education. That isn't built in. Nothing about future improvements in contraception and the availability of it. That isn't built in. Nothing about the number of people who are having to use IVF, because it is so hard to have children when you do delay. So my guess is that the UN are currently very wrong, and when they update in about a year's time, the big news will be we're back to 10 billion and we're back to before 2100. The other big unknown, which we worry about less, is ageing. We don't know how long we're going to live for. We do know that the maximum length of human life is rising linearly, in a straight line, but the country which has the highest life keeps on switching around. And we do know we get in a pretty awful state by our late 90s. So all this excitement about making it to 105 and 110, yeah. I don't get too excited about. But if somehow we manage to have... And it's sensible to think about. In 40 years ago, people would have been amazed if you said most 60-year-olds would have been incredibly healthy. We'll be talking about a retirement age of 67, 68 or 69... and not complaining that much about it, that you'd have 70-year-olds looking after 90-year-olds. They wouldn't have believed you. So we mustn't discount more healthy ageing, but that would give us a bigger number, and it would then take longer to stabilise.
Can I use this raise this at this point to say that on Friday we have the scientific advisor to Wales talking about Alzheimer's research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Very appropriate.
And it's worth talking about, because the depressing thing about ageing is if you want to know this is worth knowing for being sensible, the thing that's most likely to kill you, once you get to age 5, it's a car, all the way up to age 25. This is the most useful thing I ever tell my students. It's just, when I have to fill in these health and safety things when they go on a trip, it's just telling them just about cars. Then there are a few years where suicide's the highest risk. That's mainly because other things aren't, but it's bad. And then when you get to 7 years ago for me, it's heart attack. And now there's a number of heart attack years. Cancers are just below. And then when you get into your 80s and particularly in the 90s, we're a little bit like washing machines. All our parts have kind of got a date by which they wear out. And if it's not your brain and Alzheimer's, it's your waterworks and other things. And yeah, we haven't had to worry about this problem because so few people did get to live to an old age. It's quite a nice thing to have to worry about. In the work I do with demography, we no longer look at what's called the dependency ratio. The dependency ratio is how many people over 65 do you have compared to people of working age. And we don't look at it that way. It can look very frightening if you look at it that way. What we now do is we take how many people with just 15 years on average left to go do we have compared to younger people. And we're almost trying to invent a new kind of puberty with fairly... you know, a stage towards the end of life, which will vary and can be of a very short length or a longer length. This is a fortunate problem to have. It's just it's worth going along on Friday, because it's one we really avoid talking about, and we do avoid talking about dying.
I still think it's available for Friday.
Yeah.
Who's got another question? Yes.
I just wanted to ask you about Japan, because picked up, you know, you mentioned that Japan has successfully managed to kind of care for an older population.
Yeah.
And also, you talked about Japan as successfully responding to the, turning off the nuclear power stations. I just wonder if you think that there's some connection with their economy having been in stagnation for a long time. There's a kind of post-capitalist state they're in or something that, you know, gives them some sort of resilience or a different response?
I think we've done a really bad job of ignoring Japan for years and years and years. And it does an undercurrent of racism is the only reason. Why one of the richest countries in the world, if I always look at the 25 richest countries in the world and Japan's always in there, it's 130 million people. You know, after the USA, Japan is the biggest example. It's also very like Britain. You know, an island or a few islands, equidistant from the United States. It also had this almighty housing crash, which I just think is a good, you know, depending on what does happen in the next few months, but, you know, just remember that whatever does happen in the next few months, life didn't end in Japan. There was a point in 1988 when the gardens of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, which are very large, were valued at being worth more than the whole of California, if you could be allowed to build on them. And that was before the crash in Japan. There was a point a year ago where Kensington and Chelsea was valued at being worth more, I think, than the whole of Denmark. At some point, that will end. Japan is partly interesting because it just got there earlier. So it shows that the world doesn't end when you have fertility decline earlier than we did, when you have ageing longer than we did. Japan is very unusual because when the Americans invaded, they in effect did a natural experiment. Japan was one of the most unequal countries in the world in the 20s and 30s, had an aristocracy, land was very unevenly distributed. The Americans redistributed land and gave out land and wealth as equally as they could in the late 40s because they were extremely scared there'd be a communist revolution in Japan, not because the Americans were egalitarians. But what the Americans did was create what I still think is the most economically equal country in the rich world. People argue about the data. I think it's more equal than Norway. They created a 90% middle class, which is almost like a 90%. Well, class no longer means anything when 90% of you are in something. And I have a suspicion that that helped protect Japan. But I base a lot of this on anecdote. And we argue endlessly about this. So my favourite anecdote is the reaction to the tsunami. So I was around the States when Hurricane Katrina hit. Do you remember the reaction?
Yeah, New Orleans.
New Orleans, and the Central National Guard, and people were shot. Yeah. And America didn't deal well with that. Partly because America's very unequal. People are very frightened of each other. They don't see each other as the same, and particularly people who are very poor, who often are very black. In Japan, the reaction to the tsunami was instant help. I flew in a few weeks after. Great being a geographer because you've got an excuse to go places and fly. Just a few weeks after I flew into Japan on a plane with almost no other Westerners because people were afraid of radiation. It was obvious that they were afraid. I went to the census offices in Tokyo. I was on work to get some Japanese data. We have to go and bow a lot and ask very nicely for the data and be there. And they were taking apart these great fabricated buildings beneath us, which had been used to process all the census information. I said, what are you doing? And they said, we're sending them all up to the coast for people to live in. I said, oh, that's really good of government. And they went, no, we just decided to do that ourselves. The census office simply decided to send. And I went to the university I was working at, and the students were collecting skin cream. And they were collecting skin cream because the people in Fukushima had everything else they could need, because the response was immediately help people. And the difference between the States and Japan was just shocking. And then my big worry about this is, you know, how would we behave if London flooded? I suspect we would queue.
Do you think there is a connection with the economic stagnation that they have, you know, Japanese, as far as I understand, I mean, the Japanese economy has just been flat for quite a long time, you know, this model of constant development has ceased.
Oh, the idea of getting richer and richer.
Yeah, sort of, you know.
But there is another thing about Japan which I don't know whether you think is relevant, and that is that Japanese business takes a really long view. So Sony can think, okay, we're going to develop this technology and use it, and nowhere else in the world takes a long view like Japan. And that was
That helps. But also you can't fool shareholders in Japan to think you're suddenly going to make a profit. And also people are more locked in Japan. You know, if you speak Japanese and you want to be in Japan, whereas, you know, some of the people running our businesses, I don't know, their wife lives in Monaco and, you know, they can always go back out to their yacht or whatever. You can flee this country, you can come in, make a buck, and go away again.
Yeah.
But we just haven't looked enough at Japan.
Yeah.
Another question here, and then Jane.
I was just going to add to your stuff of Japan-based anecdotes. One of the things that I learned about at work was the way that the Japanese truck manufacturers in the Northeast reacted to the 2008 crash, which was that they didn't lay off any of their staff. They stopped making trucks because nobody wanted to buy them. Mm. But they used all that time to educate their staff. And they ran training courses and they put them through university. So they all continued to be employed, but they didn't actually build trucks.
Yeah.
But then when things picked up, they had
not what we do. But it's fascinating, you know, everything isn't perfect in Japan, and Japan was affected by the yen rising and has big problems. But the university I was in, which was in Kyoto, had a financial problem when I was there, and they simply didn't pay all staff for 1 month. They weren't going to sack anybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody was paid for a month, and that was much harder for the people who were on low pay than the people on the higher pay. Just a very different attitude. Which you have if you see other people like you. And one problem that we have, and the US has even worse, is not seeing, you know, seeing each other very different worth. I should have a house worth $500,000 because I'm special. You know, they're scroungers in that council house. And it's not our fault we've ended up there, but, you know, we are the most unequal country in Europe. And we are, if you like, the Americans of Europe. We do look a bit odd.
Jane?
I don't know if mine's just really a comment, because social inequality is my thing, and I very much like your book about why inequality exists. But if we think about sustainable societies, particularly if we're talking about inequality in the UK, I think probably that's one of the biggest pressures. And I've been looking here, and I felt a little bit more optimistic in terms of, the population might not be as bad as I thought. And, you know, there are all sorts of things that I can see on there in terms of food. But in the end, the people that, even with a slight change of anything, the people that suffer the most and very badly are the very, very poor and the world's poorest, and the people who've suffered from the recession in this country, you know, and austerity are the very, very poor. So while I sort of like those maps, they make me feel too optimistic, because I know the world for a lot of people is not like that at all. So how do we get that message? Where are the maps to get that message across? Because the people who can change things won't change things, because they're the ones benefiting it, and we're probably part of that as well. So where are the kind of, and I know your book about greed, for instance, was brilliant, but
how to show it? It's tricky, but I think when there are things that have a wider effect on wider people than just the poorest, that's one way of doing it, because you kind of get poverty fatigue. You know, we know that bottom 20% of people in Britain are the poorest in Western Europe, but we kind of get used to it. One thing that happened last year is that we had a big rise in deaths in England and Wales. 52,000 more people died in the year to July, I have to say this, 2015, than in the year to July the year before. That's the biggest rise in deaths since 1940. There were also rises in deaths in 2013 and 12. Well, the reason you didn't hear about it is that ONS, the government statisticians, completely on schedule, wasn't corrupt, the date for releasing the death figures was the 23rd of June. Right? And there hasn't been a day since the 23rd of June of no news. They, under Brexit rules, they didn't issue a press release, because all government press releases were banned. We've had very bad health in this country since 2010. Self-reported health has got much worse. We've had these small rises in deaths, a small drop in life expectancy for elderly women in 2013, then this big drop. What's interesting about or different from the very poorest is that the biggest rise in deaths has been in people in their 80s and 90s, dying 3 years earlier than they had done before. To get to your 80s or 90s in England and Wales, you're quite likely to be middle class. And in fact, you probably voted in 1979 and 83 and 87 for a particular political party. So why have we had this increase in deaths amongst the elderly and frail. It isn't because of pensions mostly, because we've had a triple lock on pensions. It's a little bit because of pension credits. Somebody's found quite a good correlation with pension credits being cut and the rise. But I think the real thing that's happened, and I can't, all the things that are really interesting, almost impossible to find evidence to prove them, I think the making the lives worse for the poor has actually resulted in more deaths for the elderly middle class. So workers in care homes who find that they're becoming poorer might also find that they need to work, say, for Uber at night to increase their income so they can pay the bedroom tax. So they're more tired, so they don't look after people in their care homes. We know the NHS had a crisis in nursing, and nurses, of course, can't afford to pay the rent to live, so big hospitals in the southeast can't get enough nurses. We have lots of frail elderly people turning up on ambulances. We had a peak of 4-hour ambulance wait. And there's a whole set of things. Visits to the elderly from their relatives dropped when petrol prices went up. Social workers' visits have halved. These are the visits you think are fairly, you know, a 15-minute visit, you make a cup of tea, say, how are you? But if you've fallen at the bottom of the stairs, there's a huge rise in deaths that's occurred. And I think if you can demonstrate these connections, which British politics has failed for 20 or 30 years to demonstrate, of how you can't just look after one section of society, a triple lock on pensions, getting an extra £20 a month, is completely useless when they cut your rural bus service and your idyllic cottage, or they cut your district hospital. And it's those, that's what, and the nice thing you can see, it gets dangerous when I start waving my hands in the air. This is the exciting thing about human geography, is that you're allowed to speculate on this, and you don't have to produce the kind of evidence that economists have to produce. You know, you can say, could it be this, could it be that? Part of the way we'll tell is, if this carries on, then it will look like it's that until we do something about society.
But then if you go in Glasgow, poorest area of Glasgow, you've got probably you've got men dying in their late 50s, working class men dying in the mid-50s, similarly as they are in North Korea.
Yeah.
So the even if you take that as a pattern, that trend is not national. It depends where you live.
Oh, it depends on the area.
So if you're in a wealthy area down the road, you might live to be 90, but you might only make it to 58.
Yeah. This is a very recent thing. It's possible that health inequalities might actually drop because the elderly middle class are dying. On Glasgow, life expectancy is less than Gaza in parts of Glasgow, so it's pretty, and it's one of the worst in Europe. But there's a real irony going on politically with these numbers at the moment. It's possible we may get a drop in inequality in health, not for a good reason, because middle class people aren't supported. The middle class use the welfare state more than anybody else. Because you live 10 years longer at the top of middle class than the working class, your use of social workers and the NHS is actually higher. John Hills did a brilliant book only a couple of years ago, as an economist in the LSE, showing that the middle class actually costs the state more than the working class because of this extra 10 years of life. And the middle class not supporting the welfare state is quite interesting from that point of view. I mean, it's loads of irony. It's not just a health inequality. I have a suspicion. I'm watching the housing market like a hawk and trying to keep myself quiet, but I keep on typing into Zoopla various London postcodes. I have a suspicion that Boris Johnson might have done more to reduce wealth inequalities and the wealth of people in Notting Hill. If the house prices in Notting Hill begin to fall, this won't make anybody richer. You know, it's not that people with nothing are going to get more. So you can get a reduction in inequality that isn't necessarily a beneficial one, but then the thing is to use it well and actually say, if our house prices fall, were they actually too high? Rather than saying we need a government to do whatever it can to get them back up again. And the other with house prices, a 1% fall in house prices every year for 30 years to normal European levels, which is that's how long it would take, that's like every trade union winning its pay claim for everybody every year. For young people and people who are renting, but we're in fascinating times.
We've got a question here, and I think we're probably going to probably meant that the last one, actually. And there's some wine at the back. Oh, no, two. Sorry, we've got two questions.
Yeah.
And then there's some wine at the back if you want to stay and have a drink. So, you first.
A slightly flippant question, but you hinted at Brexit there. I'd be interested to know whether you suspected that the uncertainty with Brexit would actually reduce the British fertility rate. But I might be reading too much into that. The slightly more serious point, if that isn't serious enough, is around those areas where we have the greatest inequality, which tend to be, you know, some of our rural areas, some of our big traditional cities that had, you know, significant amounts of industry which haven't changed. It's a very simple question with a profound. And there isn't a silver bullet to this, but what do we do to start to change that? Because I think you're right that the...
So which kinds of industry?
Sorry, I would be talking about heavy industry and deindustrialisation in the 70s and 80s. So if you're talking about valleys, if you're talking about if you're talking about the northeast, that sort of thing. I guess there's an environmental thing, there's a cultural thing, there's a societal thing that we need to change. But I think there's probably a physical thing as well that we need to change.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, the fertility one, the only region of the UK that had a growing number of British people in the last count in 2014 was London, and it was the babies. Now, the babies, a lot of them were the children of people not born in Britain, but of course, all the babies are British. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know whether... The last time we did immigration control in the 60s, we actually got a flood of people came in. I mean, I shouldn't use that word, but it was. And then we had that increased death rate because lots of people brought their elderly relatives in just in time when we took away their British passports. So attempts at immigration control tend to be pretty self-defeating. But we don't know. We do know that we've put off a lot of very skillful, nice... people are going to leave. We don't know whether they will be replaced by people who aren't as good as the people that we've really annoyed, I think. Personally, I'm you can tell I'm a middle class academic, I'm from Oxford, of course I was Remain, but I think it's possibly better that we now have to go through this than if we'd had a narrow Remain win, whereas it would just have carried on. And there's a lovely blog up today about what Brexit might actually mean and what we can do. Partly because when you look at industry, we make cars in Oxford. 1%, except for feeling I was born there, so I can. When I was born there, 40,000 men worked in the car factory. The factory now has 3,000 men. It produces more cars than ever. It's 1% of the UK's manufacturing output is the Mini. Half of those 3,000 men, and almost all men still, are Eastern European, cheap labour, on the last line with men on it. And the Germans, because BMW, are partly in Britain because they couldn't make people work for 7 hours and 20 minutes in Germany legally with just a 20 minute break to go to the toilet. There are 6 lines which are robots, 1,100 robots in Oxford, all the size that will fit in a container that you could ship to Austria if you want to move the car factory out, and the other 1,500 men fix the robots. Now that kind of industry could carry on. BMW wrote to all the workers with a very polite letter saying, if we really leave, they'll have to move the factory. The reason they have to move the factory is that a lot of the components for the cars come from the mainland. And a lot of the parts of those components come from the Midlands and England. And a lot of the parts from them are shipped in from abroad. And every time these goods cross, if you have any tariffs, the price of your Mini would double. So you can't make it. And that's why I don't think we're going to leave, because I don't think the mainland will allow us to have free movements of goods without free movements of labour. We also actually need free movement of labour. On the industry, the valleys in Wales couldn't do anything but mines. The mines in the valley are like Canary Wharf turned upside down. The number of people you could get in a mine in the valleys, there is no other industry apart from a Canary Wharf banking tower block which could employ that many people. So when the mines began to go and the houses peeled off, you know, the top of Ebbw Vale and down, there wasn't anything else. you could do for them. But I think a lot of our manufacturing industry and our shipbuilding, what's left of it, I think is going to go the way that a lot of our agricultural employment went. It is cheaper to make many of these things elsewhere, unless you make it in the way that we make minis. And we are going to shift to an even more service economy. We can do an enormous number of things for each other. I don't think we need to cut each other's hair every week, but hairdressing is an amazing business. We managed to convince men that they have to have their hair cut more than the past. That was awesome. We can do a lot of things for each other that will make our lives happier. We can have less growth than we've had before, and we can learn from places. But our growth industries are things like education. Yeah, banking was our last growth industry. I don't think the rest of the world is going to trust us as much. And it's all 12% of our GDP, 4% of our workforce. We could increase education. When I was in Sheffield, by the time I left, we had 20,000 overseas students. Caused no problem for the city whatsoever. There was no animosity, partly because housing's cheap in Sheffield. Those 20,000 students, through their fees and the £5,000 that the average family spent on graduation, including the British Airways flights from Malaysia or China or India, the entire, and it's export earnings. The export earnings was over £250 million a year from Sheffield Hallam and Sheffield University. Right. And that was bigger than the entire metalwork industry of South Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. South Yorkshire still has a metalwork industry. It's actually 65% arms, but we like to call it cutlery. It doesn't sound as bad, but the fact that in just 10 years I watched the education industry become bigger than there's a lot of things we can do for the world, and there are a lot of people who want to come here who could do it, who could do programming and other things, because we're very lucky. We've got the world language and another nice language here as well. But I love the suggestion. Do you remember the suggestion of allowing anybody in who learnt Welsh up to a certain level from the rest of the world? I thought that's quite clever. So it's quite a barrier. You know, it's much better test than having to do that British history test and learning fake history to give the right answers. Anyway, one last question.
Final question. Yeah.
Now we're on politics, I was just wondering, how do you think the change in demography, how do you think the change in demography that you were talking about earlier, so lower fertility rates, increased life expectancy across the world, is going to change politics? Because I know over the last couple of centuries there's been a big influence of labour and young people in politics. Mm. How do you think that's going to change over the next century?
How will an older population affect? I think it's harder to predict in you. The traditional thing is to say that people become more right-wing as they age. Mm-hmm. But that's partly because we had a particular generation, of which I'm only just in because I made some bad housing decisions in life, who had a lot to protect, which is the home-owning part of Britain is elderly. And the relationship between having some wealth and the Conservative Party is incredibly tight. When we had negative equity in 1990, 91, 92, a whole series of outer London boroughs turned Labour. And it was simply house price falls. So I think this kind of adage of age, of the young being optimistic and green and more left-wing, and the elderly being more conservative, is something of our particular generation. The young can behave in very different ways. In Germany in the 1930s, the young were very supportive of the Hitler Youth, and they didn't call it Take Back Control, but the Hitler Youth anthem wasn't far from that. And it was young, not old. I know there are no more questions. It's a song from Cabaret, if any of you remember it. And I can see a change for another generation. I think there's a really interesting generation coming up who are aged below 40, majority private renting, having to rent into their 30s, delaying births not because of the university degrees and the careers, but because they really don't want to have a baby in private renting, although they're having to. Absolutely fearful of sending children to school. A quarter of families in England with children now rent privately. Having to send a child to a primary school with no idea of whether the landlord will put up the rent, and you'll have to move the child to another school. And you know, it's awful moving children to school when you don't have to. And this generation is the majority of people aged under 40. There's an even angrier generation a bit younger than them who are getting their first student loan requirements, and there'll be 8 years of them by 2020. And I can see the under 40s being fairly radical, and of course every year this group gets bigger, and because of that baby boom of 46 and 47, it's getting to a point where that group of well-off elderly is going to disappear or become less powerful, and the younger elderly that will join it will not have made as much money on their houses, didn't buy the house when it was £600 and now it's worth £1.2 million. You know, you have to be very old to have done that. And I think that's the big shift. So we should look at the economic circumstances of each cohort and work out what's changing. And the other big change was that in the past, the best predictor of how a family would vote was how the man voted. And, well, we don't know, women may have lied, but, you know, tended to vote, or at least said, like the man. All that kind of behaviour has completely changed. The idea that you would, you know, vote the same way as your partner, or behave like your parents. And you're much more influenced by your friends now. That will change. I suspect by the time you're my age, there'll be 8 or 9 political parties in Britain and we'll have PR.
Hurrah.
It's just how we might get there. But it's what most of the rest of Europe and almost all of the rest of the rich world has, apart from Japan and America. But it doesn't always, and Singapore, but it doesn't always fit. So sorry for a waffly final answer. I did warn you about us trying to answer things when we didn't know. I think that was a good example of me trying to do that. So please share a drink.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you.